My name is Troy Klein, and welcome to another Sun Earth Day Highlights podcast. A total solar eclipse will occur on August 1st, 2008, and it'll be visible from within a narrow corridor that will traverse half the Earth. The path of the moon's umbral shadow will actually begin in Canada and extend across northern Greenland, the Arctic, central Russia, Mongolia, and then China. The Sun Earth Day team plans to bring that entire event to you with a live webcast from China, and you can get more information about that webcast by visiting the Sun Earth Day homepage. Now, in today's podcast, we'll continue our talk with eclipse expert Fred Espenak, and he'll tell us about his career at NASA and how he became an astronomer. So what influenced Fred's decision to pursue a career in astronomy? When did he realize that he wanted to be an astronomer? What led to his interest in working at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center? And what does he enjoy most about his job? Well, let's find out.
I think once I had decided that I wanted to pursue a career in astronomy, once I did a little bit of reading on it, it was clear that what I really needed to do was study physics and math. The astronomy comes really after that. To be a good astronomer, you have to be a physicist and to know enough math to be able to use the physics. So that's what got me started in my college career, was studying physics. One event that I recall was when my parents woke me up, got me out of bed. It seemed like the middle of the night, but it was probably only 10 p.m. But it was when the Echo satellite passed overhead. I think it was around 1958 or 1959. And I still remember getting up and seeing that satellite moving across the sky. And that was at the dawn, the birth of the space age. Another thing that I recall as a boy getting interested in astronomy was I must have been about 7 or 8 years old, and I was visiting my grandparents out in their summer home in Long Island. And one of the neighborhood boys had a small telescope. And I remember taking a look at the moon through that telescope for the first time. And I think I pestered my father for 2 years after that before I got my first telescope. And that just ignited my interest in astronomy. Well, I remember, I think I was in high school at the time. There was one book, one popularized book that came out called Red Giants and White Dwarfs by Robert Jastrow. And he was sort of the Carl Sagan of his day, popularizing astronomy. And he was on some of the talk shows and things. But I remember reading that book and the discussions in there in very clear layman's terms about stellar evolution and black holes. And that really captivated me in terms of a public spokesman for astronomy. Probably most of what I learned about astronomy when I was a young high school student came from magazines like Sky and Telescope magazine or books that I would take out of the library. My career choice, I had to make a decision at some point because as much as I loved astronomy, my first love and still a passion is dinosaurs. But that's probably true of almost every boy in America. But it dawned on me, I think, during high school that the job opportunities for vertebrate paleontologists who actually work on dinosaur bones, there are probably 100 of them in the world. So compare that to astronomy and astrophysics, and there were a lot more job opportunities. When I was finishing up my work in graduate school, it was time to start looking for work in the real world and get out of the school environment, which was a scary thing. One of my classmates from graduate school who had graduated a year ahead of me had come down to Maryland and was working as a computer contractor here at Goddard. And I talked to him a little bit about it, and he said that the work was really interesting down here. So I ended up coming down and interviewing with his company and actually working as one of the Beltway Bandits, one of the contractors, for a few years before I got hired on through Goddard itself. I really enjoy interacting with a lot of the emails and questions that people ask about eclipses. I get questions from a lot of school kids about using eclipse diagrams or when the next eclipse is going to take place. And a lot of their input inspires me for some of the content that ends up getting added onto the Eclipse page. Like about a year ago, from all these questions, a lot of questions are, when is the next eclipse in San Francisco? Or when's the next eclipse in Chicago? And I thought long and hard about this, and we got a program up and running on the website called the Solar Eclipse Explorer. And what anybody can do with that little program is plug in, there are some drop-down menus, so you can pick a city, any place around the world. If you don't have, if the city isn't included, you can just plug in the latitude and longitude. And it's just a matter of hitting a couple of buttons at that point, and it'll generate a table describing all the eclipses visible from that city for 100 years in the past or future.
My last question to Fred was, what advice can you give others who share your interest in eclipses?
I think the beauty of a solar eclipse is something that anybody can appreciate. And what I usually tell people is, if they ever have the opportunity to see a total solar eclipse, or if they're on a vacation someplace and a total solar eclipse just happens to be taking place nearby, it happens. I always urge people, get into the path of the total eclipse. A lot of people have emailed me and said, well, I'm going to be on a Caribbean island and it's outside the path, but I'm going to see 98% of the eclipse or 99% of the eclipse. That's good enough, right? No. No. The difference between a 99% partial eclipse and a 100% total eclipse is greater than the difference between a 0% partial and a 99% partial. That extra 1% gets you into the actual path of the moon shadow, and that's where you have to go to see the sun's corona and see this darkening of the daylight and to see stars and planets revealed in the daytime sky. And it's an absolutely spectacular thing that nobody should miss if they get a chance to see it. The sad thing about it is that if you're at, statistically, if you're at any one given point on the Earth's surface, the odds are you'll only get an eclipse at that point once every 375 years. So most people live their lifetimes without a chance to see an eclipse if they stay in one spot on the Earth's surface. That means most of the time you have to be willing to travel and move around to see an eclipse.
I'd like to give a special thanks to Fred Espenak for taking time to share all of this amazing information with us, and we look forward to more eclipse chats in the future. In upcoming podcasts, we'll hear from Lou Mayo, who will fill us in on the latest Sun Earth Day supported eclipse activity for amateur astronomers. We'll also hear from the chief editor of the Sun Earth Day's Technology Through Time series, Sten Odenwald, and he'll tell us about the latest eclipse editions. I hope you enjoyed this Sun Earth Day Highlights podcast, and we're very interested in hearing your questions and comments. If you have something to say, just send an email to sunearthday@gmail.com. If selected, we'll share it in one of our upcoming podcasts. For all other details about the Sun Earth Day program, including information about our past Sun Earth Day themes, be sure to visit our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. And don't forget that you can learn more about NASA by simply visiting www.nasa.gov. Sun Earth Day is a program sponsored by the NASA Sun Earth Connection Education Forum at the Goddard Space Flight Center and at the UC Berkeley Space Sciences Laboratory.